Here's the quick counterattack. It's Padre back in action, denied by Vasilevsky. Oh, what a play! Colorado thinks this is in. I think it is in. We are looking for the signal from the officials. They're going to take a look at the replay for sure. They think they have won the game.
We have a goal.
It's a goal and a heroic return to action for Nazem Kadri.
Nazem Kadri with the game-winning goal last night as the Avs take a commanding 3-1 lead in the Stanley Cup Finals. The second time they were able to win in overtime. They were down 2-1, tied it in third in Tampa, and then win. And I was watching the overtime. Listen, overtime hockey's exciting. Game sevens are exciting in any sport. But I'm watching this in overtime, and the Avs are having shot after shot after shot on goal. I felt sorry for the Tampa Bay Lightning goaltender, who was magnificent last night, but he was just absolutely under siege. And eventually, Colorado broke through. And what was crazy was nobody on the ice knew that they had scored, except one Colorado player goes, "Hey, look at this thing called a puck. It's right inside the net here. That should count." And they went to the review, and they made sure, and yeah. Sure as heck, it was a game-winning goal for a guy that just came back from thumb surgery, and it was his first game back. He has the game-winning goal, and the Colorado Avalanche are one win away from their first Stanley Cup title since 2001, as they will have a chance to win it on their home ice, Game 5, tomorrow night in Denver. And they have been really, really good on their home ice. In fact, they're good everywhere in the playoffs. Colorado's road record in the playoffs is 8-1. So they have to feel pretty good of, even if they lose Game 5, to go to Tampa, win in Game 6. If not, win at home, Game 7. Avalanche in control. Only one time in Stanley Cup final history has a team been down 3-1 and come back to win the Stanley Cup. And you have to go back 80 years to 1942, when all of us were clearly not alive. And the Maple Leafs came back actually from 3-0, and they were down 3-1, came back and won it. So history bodes well for the Colorado Avs as they win Game 4 last night. Welcome to Sports Ticket. Wade, Dusty, and Jason with you. I don't think there's anything to say local sports-wise, but I'll throw it to you just in case.
No, nothing really going on right now anyway.
All right. That's why he's the best color commentator in the league for nothing, folks. Yep. Nope. Got nothing.
I got to have something to provide commentary the best. Right?
I mean, you could make something up, you know, like, local sports information available, ncksports.com, and go back, look at all the athletes of the week, which we had some recently. And I mean, there's still stuff there. But
kid in the yellow shorts beat the kid in the red tank top at the hoop the other day. Nice. 7-5, you know, something like that.
That's good. Yeah. The guy, if Travis Litton is listening right now, he's going to really probably drive off the road when I share this one. But the guy in the white, anyway, the white tank top with the pink fanny pack. that guy was very impressive as he walked around the basketball court in front of everyone. A middle-aged guy with a pink shorts, a white tank top, and a fanny pack.
Oh, boy.
Nothing says coolness like that. And I was sitting next to Travis Litton, and I said, "Dude, I think you could pull that off." And if you know who Travis Litton is, he's a big guy. Of course, played football at K-State. He started laughing when I told him that. He says, "You know, if I did do that, it would be on the radio the very next day." I said, "Hell yeah, it would be.
Yeah,
it would. I guarantee it would be. You know me well. Absolutely,
yeah,
I would.
You can't be a person like that and try to pull that off in front of people and not have people talking about it."
You know, honestly, this guy actually pulled it off okay. Travis Litton or myself would fail miserably, go down in a heap of flames, no doubt about it. Let's see. Are the Royals improving? So the Royals have had a decent West Coast swing. They won 2 out of 3 against Oakland, lost 2 out of 3 to the Giants. They've won 2 out of 3 against the Angels. So it's been a 5-4 is that road trip on the West Coast. That's not bad. Angels aren't horrible. A's aren't good. Giants are really solid. But when the Royals lose, they just check out offensively. I mean, they just lose. That's the 10th time, I think, now they've been shut out. They're on pace for near a record for shutouts in a season offensively. Of course, Shohei Ohtani, at least he's legitimate. He was fantastic last night. 13 strikeouts. The Royals were in it until the fifth inning. Lynch, Daniel Lynch, matching 0-for-0, but couldn't keep it going as the Angels get one in the fifth, add two in the seventh against Amir Garrett, two more against Foster Griffin for the five-run lead. Lynch is now 3-7, despite getting just one run and 4 2/3, which I still say if a starting pitcher that young can only go 4 2/3, we're in trouble. But that's a good outing nowadays. That's Royals baseball for you. Ohtani is the first player to ever drive in at least 8 runs and strike out at least 10 batters in consecutive games, because the night before last, he hit 2 homers, a 3-run homer to tie it. He had 8 RBIs, and the Angels lost 12-11. And Joe Maddon's sitting at home going, glad you fired me, because I didn't want to go through that. And, you know, Ohtani, Mike Trout, the Angels have talent, but yet they underachieve. It doesn't matter what manager they have. Probably more maddening than watching Royals baseball, because you just know that they don't have, like, superstars left and right, whereas the Angels have a couple of the best players in all of the big leagues. And so the Angels get the win last night. Ohtani with 13 strikeouts at 8 innings, gave just 2 hits and had a walk. Royals are 25-43 after the loss. Angels 34-38. Royals have an off day today. Woohoo! Can't lose. And then they get ready for a 3-game series against the A's, which will start tomorrow there in KC as they're back at Kauffman Stadium. Really fun stuff here. Toronto Blue Jays hitting coach Guillermo Martinez was ejected prior to yesterday's game against the White Sox following a heated lineup card exchange. That's right. He came to home plate. He had the lineup card ready to go, and it was a carryover from the previous game. On Tuesday, Martinez confronted home plate umpire Doug Eddings about questionable officiating decisions made during the previous day's game. During Tuesday's game between the Blue Jays and White Sox, Eddings' wide strike zone calls marred the game and frustrated the Blue Jays to no end, as multiple sources credited Eddings with missed calls, 6 blown strikeouts, and get this, measly 64% strike accuracy rate. That is horrendous. The officiating contributed to what ended up being a 7-6 White Sox win in 12 innings, so it sounds like the Blue Jays have a reason to be very upset. So their hitting coach goes ahead and takes one for the team and gets ejected the day after exchanging the lineup card. A couple things here, one on each of these stories. First of all, for the Blue Jays and the situation with the umpires, 64% strike accuracy rate is one of the worst I've ever seen in my life. The umpires get graded. Now, I don't want to be tough on umpires, but these are big league umpires paid considerably good money, and these are pros. If this was, you know, if this was our, you know, 9 and under kids pitch league and the umpire was only 64%, you know what? He's only getting $25 a game. I think we can cut him some slack, right? But these are pros. Doug Eddings been in the league for a while. I think he has. I'd have to double check that. But when you're at the big league level, Todd Tishner, who's from Southwest Kansas, we've had on his show multiple times over the years. Great guy. He's in his 40s, living the dream in regards to this is what he wanted to do, be a Major League Baseball umpire. And, of course, umpiring, officiating anything is not easy. Totally get that. And Todd Tishner has one of the best strike accuracy rates, which is in the mid to upper 90s. In fact, I think if Todd told me correctly, I'm going off my memory bank. I'm getting older, so I tend to forget things. But I think he said anything under 95% is not that good. Under 95%. Like, they get a report, and it shows all their missed calls when they're calling balls and strikes. They get a report, and it shows you miss this pitch, you miss this pitch in the fourth inning, you miss this pitch on the sixth inning, you miss 4 pitches in the third inning, and you miss 10 pitches on the night or whatever it is. And you divide that into, of course, how many pitches are thrown in the game, which there's a lot nowadays, which makes it even harder for umpires because you got more pitchers, different arm angles, different movement. So, you know, it's something that's never really brought up in defense of umpires in the big leagues is you got more pitchers to look at, more pitches that happen in games, and that's why the games last 3.5 hours, than they used to back in the day, say in the early 80s and 70s and even in the 80s. And so, but Doug Eddings, let me repeat this, 95% is, like, for some umps, not really acceptable. Doug Eddings, according to this, was 64%. I hope it was just a bad day. Because if he has a few of those, he should be demoted.
Right. Absolutely.
That's brutal. I mean, I think we all have a chance to get 6 out of 10 right.
Yeah. I've seen...
I close my eyes and guess. I'm getting 50.
People on Twitter post, like, Angel Hernandez, who's kind of infamous for being a little off. You know, they'll put his grade on there and it'll be like 88.
Uh-huh. Oh, it's not good.
Yeah, so that's not great. You know, for that game, it's like 88. But I think they really get mad at, like, there's just 3 or 4 that are just like, what are you looking at? You know, that's that's what they get. But to have that on there for a guy that's kind of infamous for being a little shaky behind the plate, then to drop to 64, that is, holy cow, that is quite the drop. So, I hope it's I hope that's not a trend, because, I mean, I don't know, you know, what are the Blue Jays supposed to think? I don't know. It's just, is that supposed to be personal, or is that on purpose? It's almost hard to do accidentally, but yes.
Well, Pat Hoberg leads Major League Baseball umpires with an accuracy rating of 96.4. That's a lot better than 64 or 88. 96.4, and their USA Today has a whole story on him. Just 2 weeks ago, they posted it. You probably haven't heard of Major League Baseball's most accurate umpire, which is Pat Hoberg. How accurate are MLB umpires on ball strikes? It used to be 99.5 to 95%. That's like I said, 95% is where you want to be, or better. But there is a range, according to another story from October last year, 91% to 95.6. If you're at 95%, you're doing a really, really, really good job. A really good job. If you're doing 64%, you should be demoted, without question. And I'm pulling up another story here to see if they've got a little bit more deal here. 94% is the league average for umpires for ball strikes. 94%. So Doug Eddings, according to this report, was 30% off the average in a bad way. Yeah, and you wonder why people want robot umps? That would be one. Last year, the least accurate were Rob Drake and Ron Culpa at 91.5. The most consistent was Pat Hoberg again at 98%. That guy needs to tell everybody how to ump. Apparently, Pat Hoberg needs to bring in Doug Eddings and say, here's what a strike looks like. And the least consistent, Hunter Wendelstedt at 92.9%. I'm going to try to see if I can find this, because I'm very interested in seeing what Doug Eddings, because I don't want to be too mad at a guy that's trying to do his job, but at the same time, that's alarming. He missed 30 calls, according to this article the other night, in the worst game behind the plate all of Major League Baseball season. But I'm trying to see. He got 80. Now, see, here in this story, he only got 89% accurate due to the sheer amount of pitches, but he missed 29 pitches. Mm-hmm. So there was a ton of pitches. 89% is not good either. Angel Hernandez is at 88%. That's well below the average and where Major League Baseball wants it to be. That means you miss one out of every 10 strike pitch counts, which happens. That means every other batter, at least, you're missing at least one call.
And they said 6 blown strikeouts. That's earlier in the article there. And that
means you're ringing people up, because he was ringing people up when he shouldn't have been, when they weren't strikes. Yep. Wow, that's interesting stuff. And then back to the first story. Are the Royals improving?
I would say they're steadying. I don't know if they're no longer taking on water, maybe for a little bit. But
the highs seem to be higher offensively as the season kind of goes on, but the lows are staying real low, right? Like you said, if they're not on that night, they're not on. Mm-hmm. Like, they're getting shut out. They're on pace. I can't judge it based on this road trip, because sure, they got some. They won against the Giants. I'll give them credit for that. But the A's are not good. The Angels are kind of not good right now, right? Like, they started real good, but I need to see it against some quality teams consistently to try to get some wins in those areas for me to say. I would say they're slightly improving.
Yeah.
Based on what I'm seeing here, but again, it's hard to judge that because they're not playing great teams right now. That's how I would answer that question.
Right.
I'll be a little positive. I'll say they are improving a little bit. There doesn't seem like they have I guess I'm not looking up every single box score, but it doesn't seem like they're having a starting pitcher just get out blasted every. Often as they were earlier in the season, and the offense is a little bit better. You see some of the averages and, you know, guys like Whit Merrifield and Carlos Santana were down at the 150 range for a while. You know that's not going to last all season long, but, you know, those averages have come up a little bit. So, yeah, I'd say improving a little, but I'm not going to go out and, you know, buy a whole bunch of stock right now in the row. I want to see it for 6-8 weeks. Then I'll be a little more impressed, but I'll try to be a little positive.
I got a question. I have a question I got texted. How do you come up with the winners for the Dairy Queen on Monday and Wednesday? Trivia question.
Yeah, just a trivia question.
Like, I'm like, we've been doing that for quite some time.
Like the last one
we used to have Stump the Water Side Wake Up Guys, but that was a plethora of sponsors, and then we rotated gift certificates. Yeah. But yeah, we don't now. We do a free Blizzard to Dairy Queen in Beloit on Monday and Wednesday. But I got to ask that question. Like that's been changed for quite some time. But anyway, very very interesting. I will let that person know. So, anyway, back to the deal. Cubs update with Justin Broadfoot.
Brought to you by Barack Obama, famous Chicagoan.
Oh, wow. I'm sure that made everybody happy listening in Republican waters of North Central Kansas.
I said Michelle Obama yesterday.
Oh, did you? Yeah. Nice. We're going to go through the whole family day by day.
Right.
It's the Obama week. This week's Cubs updates brought to you by the Obama family.
Tomorrow will be the kids. Yeah.
Perfect.
14-5, Chicago wins.
Oh, they scored 14.
Yeah, they scored 14.
I thought for sure they had lost 14-5.
Yeah. So they lose 2 out of 3 to the Pirates, but they score some runs last night.
Yeah. Mentioned the Avs are 1 win away from getting it done. Oklahoma is into the National Championship Series.
2-2 pitch. Caught on and missed. Oklahoma is headed to the College World Series final.
All right, so Oklahoma is going to the National Championship Series in Omaha. 5-1 win over number 5, Texas A&M yesterday, eliminating Aggies from the tournament. 3-run homer from Jimmy Crooks in the first inning. Sophomore pitcher David Sandlin struck out a career-high 12 in 7 innings. He was fantastic. It'll be either Arkansas or Ole Miss in the National Championship Series. The Razorbacks won 3-2 over the Rebels last night to force a winner-take-all for the second spot in the Championship Series. And we'll battle Oklahoma. The two teams will play again this afternoon at 3 o'clock elimination game. Ole Miss, Arkansas at Charles Schwab Field there in Omaha. And then Oklahoma and the winner of that will play the best 2 out of 3 for the national championship. And it is interesting. You look at the teams that made it to the College World Series and all the ranked teams are gone, I believe. So Arkansas, I think Arkansas is not ranked either.
Nobody's ranked.
They're all gone. Oklahoma wasn't ranked. Oklahoma, last time they were in the championship series or championship game, they won in 94. So it's been a while since Oklahoma's been in this situation when it comes to baseball. But, you know, Tennessee was number one team pretty much all year. 57-3, did not make it to the College World Series. Ole Miss was one of the last ones to get into the tournament. Now they are 1 win away from playing for the national championship, which is crazy. But Stanford's ranked 2nd. They're out. Auburn was ranked 14th. They're out. A&M ranked 5th. They're out. Texas was the favorite coming into this thing. And, of course, they do what they normally do when people jump on their bandwagon. They crash it into a building or off a cliff. So the College World Series has unranked teams. And this just goes to show you. And, you know, I hear so many people, and I understand it. We've talked about it before. You know, rankings, you know, high school sports rankings. Well, we're offended. Our team should be ranked. I mean, I've heard it from Dusty's relation. I've heard it from coaches. I've heard it from people I know. And people get all riled up. And it's like, it's just pointless to get all riled up about rankings. If that serves as extra motivation for your kids to play better, then use it all you need to. I understand. Use it as a tool. But it doesn't matter, because in high school sports in the state of Kansas and across the country, you actually play it out. You don't get placed based on where people vote you number 3 in the KBC and 2A basketball. They play it out. So what do you know? You know, the NCAA tournament rankings don't mean anything. The NCAA tournament, the rankings mean nothing. The seed means something. Like we've talked about before, it doesn't matter where you're ranked. You're going to be seeded differently than what you're ranked. Now, if you're one of the top 4 teams in the country, more than likely you're going to be a 1 seed. But Gonzaga was 6th in the country 1 year and got a 6 seed. So you can't go by rankings. And Kansas this year was, of course, to me and many other people, were the weakest of the ones this year. And some people said they probably more of a like a two seed. And they won it all. We've seen six seeds win the national championship. I mean, we saw Kansas in 1988 win it all. The point I'm trying to make is rankings are sweet and all, but it doesn't guarantee a jack squat. You get into the tournament, same thing in football, the college football playoff. Rankings, the when they come up with the selection or the release of the rankings in regards to the college football playoff. Now, that's a ranking. You know, they're worried about the top four. So there's a ranking. But the poll rankings mean nothing. So in general, pretty much most of the rankings mean nothing in all of these sports. For the most part.
Yeah.
I get people all riled up. Ooh, the Chiefs are fifth in power rankings. Who cares? It's some arbitrary person pulling stuff out of their you-know-what and throwing a dart at a board. It don't matter. Oh, the Chiefs are picked fourth by some Joe Schmo in Delaware. In the AFC West this year, they picked 10-7. Somebody told me that the other day. I said, why do you worry about this? Like, it doesn't matter what people think before the season. It doesn't matter what the so-called experts and pundits say, what we say or anybody else on national TV. It does not matter where people rank these teams. It doesn't matter, all right, at all. College baseball is a great example of this. Not a single ranked team is still alive. The three teams left are unranked. That means they're not in the top 25.
Right.
I mean, that means that the top 25 teams in America at the end of the season, according to the so-called experts and pundits and voters, were dead wrong. And here's the other thing. You rank it based on the totality of the season. What you don't factor in rankings is, what if you get a stud pitcher back middle of the year? What if you get a stud player back right before the College World Series? Well, I mean, we've seen this in other sports before. I mean, we saw it with the Bob Sanders came back for the Indianapolis Colts, and this Colts defense was like second to last that year. And Peyton Manning, it's like, oh, Manning never can win a Super Bowl. He doesn't have enough defense, but he got great offense, and da-da-da-da-da. Bob Sanders comes back for the playoffs, and at safety, he's a leader of the defense. The Colts have the best defense in the playoffs, and what do you know? Peyton Manning wins his first Super Bowl. The rankings don't mean anything. Well, the Chiefs are 28th in defense going into the playoffs. I don't care. It don't matter to me. I mean, I'm concerned, but all that matters is, do they put together their best game in the next playoff game to keep their season alive? I mean, you don't have to be number one in defense and number one in offense to win the Super Bowl. You don't. You have to be number one in either one. There's teams that have actually been top 10 in two, or top 10 in one category and top 20 in the other. There's all kinds of combinations. But one thing that rankings don't factor in is they don't factor in momentum. They don't factor in who's playing the best ball at the end of the year. All right? And right now, the teams playing the best ball are Arkansas, Ole Miss, and Oklahoma. Those are the best teams in baseball right now. And guess what? Tennessee's sitting there. Well, look at me, 57-3. Yeah, congrats. You didn't even make it to the quarterfinals. You didn't, which that's what it is. College World Series is the final eight. You didn't make it there. Well, Kentucky was the number two seed this year. Well, they blew out Kansas at Allen Fieldhouse. Congratulations. You're one of the top eight teams in the country pretty much all year long. You lost to St. Peter's. I mean, it seeding matters, but rankings rarely do.
Also, especially college baseball would be a good example of this. The structure of your postseason as opposed to the structure of your season matters. A team like Arkansas, who maybe, you know, the SEC obviously tough with a lot of teams there at the end, you know, maybe didn't have a third and fourth starter or a third or fourth guy in the bullpen that could win them games in the middle of the season. You know, when you're playing Thursday, a night game on Thursday, or night game on Friday, two on Saturday, one on Sunday, you know, maybe they don't have the depth to get them through a bunch of those four-game series against good SEC teams. But maybe they do have two really good starters and three guys in the bullpen that can really get them through, say, a double elimination tournament here in Omaha, or, you know, whether that's, you know, Oklahoma or who are these teams that are left. We saw it a little bit with North Carolina in basketball. They struggled for two-thirds of the season when they had to get through the whole season playing seven, eight, nine guys. When it came time for postseason and crunch time, and you don't have to get through the whole grind, you whittle it down to your top five or six, play them the most, and then, you know, they were a little bit more top heavy. So it's also top heavy teams are going to have an advantage in certain postseason formats. Now, you know, the NBA playoffs are a long, drawn-out process. You might need a little more depth to your team than, say, just two really good players. I mean, two really good players will carry you a long ways, but you might need a little bit more than, say, college baseball, where two starters can take you almost all the way themselves and one hot hitter. So I think that's a big part of how some of these sports work, too, is you don't have to be great in the regular season if the postseason structure is a whole lot different or shorter than the regular season.
What do you think, Dusty? Rankings agree, or do you think they matter in some way?
I have always said the only sport where rankings matter, as far as the big stuff we talk about, mm-hmm. is college football.
Right.
That's it. The rest of it is go out and play. Pro sports rankings don't matter at all. No, like your power rankings, whatever it is, you go out and play.
Any sport with
seeded,
a playoff, yeah. for the most part.
Yeah, you go out and play. You're seeded. You do what you do, and whatever. Now rankings should matter in like some of the Division II playoffs and maybe Division III in NCAA, but apparently they don't for some teams that should have gotten into the right. men's basketball tournament, Fort Hayes, this year, that did not, and their rankings were better than some that did. So I would say sometimes they do matter, but not for what we're talking about here, mm-hmm. as far as some of those high-profile sports and those sports, like you said, that have a playoff mm-hmm. that – you know, you're pretty much going to get into this thing if you have that kind of team anyway, right? Like, mm-hmm. I know it's limited to 68 in men's basketball. It's limited to probably, I think it's 64 in baseball. You're limited on the number of spots that are in, but if you're good enough to win it all, the rankings don't matter even
right.
a little bit.
Right.
You just go out and you play, and you wherever you're placed, you take that and you run with it, and you beat whoever you need to beat to get to where you need to go. And LSU's obviously a team that didn't do that. The teams that are alive right now that weren't seeded or ranked going into the baseball tournament, they did do it. Tennessee, yeah. Mm-hmm. Tennessee didn't do that, but the teams that are ranked or that were not ranked did do that, and they went and did what they needed to do and got themselves in the right position to possibly win a national championship. Ranking didn't matter for Oklahoma in softball, but they were so dominant that who cares about a ranking anyway, right? Like,
right.
if you're that dominant and you can go out and win, it doesn't matter what your ranking is either. You know, you just went out and did what you needed to do. Same way everybody else can try to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Also, I don't think some of the people that actually do the rankings treat them truly as rankings. They still kind of treat them as a punishment and reward. What, you know, sometimes boggles my mind is number one will play against number two. Say number two wins. They'll just drop number one down to like four or five.
Mm-hmm.
What? Like, no, they could still be the second best team
yeah,
in
right.
the country.
They just maybe switched places.
Yeah, switch yeah. places.
You or know. Some team beat somebody head to head, but they're ranked ahead of them, and they just played 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
It's like, why?
Because you won four games in a row after you went head to head, and you get the reward of winning right. and moving up. Right. I don't understand. So, yeah, sometimes people use it as punishment reward instead of like really thinking about the rankings. Like
rankings are nice for us in the media because we can promote it that way. You know, we'll say, you know, number one Osborne versus number two Hanover. That helps, you know, promote it. That's
yeah.
no doubt. But in regards to, you know, does Hanover and Osborne ranked 1-2, does that mean they're going to be in the eight-man championship game? No, of course not. They've got to get there. And, you know, I always use this example. I've used this a few times of how flawed the rankings are when it comes to high school sports, because you don't even realize how many people don't even vote on this. Mm-hmm. They send it out to coaches or ADs or whatever, and many don't even send them back.
Right.
So there might be 12 people that are deciding the top 10 in every class, and they only know one class.
Yeah.
And that's the one they play in. They don't know anything about it. So they go by names. And I remember one year Beloit had lost a lot from the year before the boys did, and they started year 0-2 and they moved up in the rankings, and then they won 3 in a row or 1-2 in a row and dropped out of the rankings.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow, that just shows the whole flaw of the rankings right there.
I think Gonzaga is a good example. They get, I think they've had both ends of this before. There's times when like they're rated high and don't get a great seed or mm-hmm. something like that. But then there's times when they are, you know, at some point they might play a tough non-conference schedule, win some, lose some, and they're sitting there at like 14th. Well, when it comes time to conference, they're not in as good of a conference.
Right.
So they don't lose as often.
Right.
And so like teams like in the Big Ten and Pac-12 and stuff are beating up on each other, but Gonzaga just keeps winning. Mm-hmm. So they just keep moving them up
on the rankings.
And then in that particular year, they might not be
right.
that great of a team, right. but just because they keep winning in a weaker conference, they just keep moving up.
But that goes to my point. You go mm-hmm. to the seeding, they don't care when they seed right. you. Oh, yeah. Gonzaga is sixth in the country, but they played nobody, and Michigan's 23rd. Michigan's played a tough, tough schedule. Michigan's going to get a better seed, and they
yeah.
should.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
they should. So we were talking about this earlier today on Waterside Wake Up for just a moment, Dusty. I got to get your input on this. I think it's safe to say that OU, Nebraska, and Texas, I think we can all say that they should maybe think about getting rid of their football programs. Take some of the money they spend and put it into some of these other sports. Well, really, there's no need because these other sports they're pretty good at. I mean, everybody knows, I think it's clear, Cornhusker fans know this, that football at Nebraska, at best, is the third best sport on campus. At best. If you're lucky, it's third.
Mm-hmm.
Volleyball and bowling, way more successful than Nebraska football right now.
Mm-hmm.
Notice I said right now. Okay, Texas. Football went 5-7 and can't beat a walk-on tight end from Plainville catching a ball in double overtime on a two-pointer and lost to a kid that hadn't started all year long, quarterback, basically. Texas, 5-7 in football, but they won three national championships this year. We believe it was tennis, track and field, and there was one other one.
Rowing, I think.
I don't know if it was. Whatever. Yeah. Who cares, right? And then they made it to the College World Series in softball. They weren't ranked, and then they made it to the Men's College World Series. So Texas had a really good year sports wise. But do you think?
Sixth best.
Yeah,
at best.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. That's what I was trying to get to. So Nebraska at best, their football program is third best. At Texas at best, it's sixth best. All right. Oklahoma, champions of softball and women's gymnastics this year, I've been told. Runner-up in men's gymnastics and women's tennis. And I'm not going to lie to you, I didn't know Oklahoma had a gymnastics program.
I did, actually. There's a
okay.
Athlete A, watch it on Netflix. It's about the Larry Nassar thing. And,
okay.
and their Athlete A ended up going to Oklahoma okay. to do gymnastics.
So otherwise, you might not even
know
they had it.
I probably wouldn't have known that other than that.
They made the Final Four men's golf, Sweet 16 women's basketball. That's kind of a stretch. Of course, they're in the championship in baseball now, as we established. So what we're trying to say here, let's see here. Softball's better than football at Oklahoma, women's gymnastics, baseball, men's gymnastics, women's tennis. You know what? It's Oklahoma's football program at best is the sixth best sport on campus in Norman. Think about this for a second. Nebraska is probably not even third if I really break down the other stuff.
Women's basketball made the tournament.
Okay, so
this last year.
Nebraska slides to four.
Baseball's
in
had a good season.
Slide to five.
In the last few years.
Mm-hmm. Luckily, men's basketball is bad, so that helps
yeah,
football.
Wrestling, I think, is probably consistently better. The last few years.
So it's safe to say, just to save a lot of time here, and blanket statement all three of these juggernaut football programs, and obviously Nebraska and Texas have fallen on hard times, and Texas lets the inmates run the asylum, and Nebraska took a whole bunch of money to suck. And then you got Oklahoma that's, you know, good, but not good enough, so they're going to bolt the Big 12 to join the SEC, and their coach leaves to go to USC.
Can't keep a coach around.
Can't keep their coach around, and they have this great program. So if I hope you note the facetiousism. Is that not even a word? That we're facetious here and sarcastic. But it is safe to say here, I think we've come to the conclusion, and this ranking is ironclad, that Nebraska football, Texas football, and Oklahoma football considered three of the best football programs in the history of college football. I think nobody could disagree with that, mm-hmm. right? Well-known brand names. All three of those programs are spending hundreds of millions of dollars, honestly, over the years on their football program, if not eventually a billion, the way they're going in SEC when Texas and Oklahoma go to the SEC. I think we can all agree that Nebraska and Oklahoma and Texas, at best, all three of those football programs, at best, are sixth best on their campuses, respectively.
I like how we just ranked them when we just said,
yeah, I know.
Don't
I know. That's what I'm having fun with. Because these are facts. These rankings, they don't play each other. I mean, the football players don't have to compete gymnastically.
These rankings matter.
You know, remember the wild world of sports where they had these competitions? Okay, the Oklahoma football players will now get on the balance beam. The gymnastics, the men's gymnastics teams will now run the wishbone. Yeah. Now we actually play it out and see who are really the greatest athletes. I don't think an offensive lineman's going to be able to do the rings. I'm just going to throw it out there. I don't think the little guy that does the balance beam for men's gymnastics at 105 pounds is probably going to be a running back or a nose guard. But it is interesting that, and let's get serious for a moment, football, we keep hearing, is that's the cat's meow, right? It's all about football. Everything revolves around football. That's where everybody puts their money into is football. And yet at Oklahoma, Nebraska, and Texas, when the football programs get a huge percentage and chunk of the money and the donors give a lot of money to that program, all these other sports are flourishing at Nebraska and Texas and Oklahoma in particular. And Nebraska's definitely got a few winning national championships in sports and bowling and volleyball. That football might be number one. And it is the biggest revenue enhancer or revenue stream, and there's a lot of money poured into it and so forth and so on. And some people could argue, well, here your point, Wade, is that here's where you want to say, Wade, is that all of those football programs help allow all these other programs to be so great. So when you say Oklahoma football is sixth best on campus or Nebraska football or Texas football, all those five teams on campus that are better should grovel back to the football team and go, thank you so much for playing football because that allows us to have a team. And that's kind of true, actually, because football revenue, you know, gymnastics isn't making money at Oklahoma, I think it's safe to say. I think we're safe to say that bowling and volleyball is not making a lot of money at Nebraska. And I think tennis is not rolling in with the admission at the gate at Texas or track and field. So football does fund a lot of this, but I do find it interesting that at three major known over the years, right now obviously Nebraska, Texas struggling, Oklahoma still solid, but over the years those are three brand names in football. And we're joking about it, but really honestly, they are sixth best on campus at best.
Yeah, for production and what they're doing. Yeah,
results.
Which is wild to say that about Oklahoma football because they're still always in the conversation for the playoff, right?
Which tells you a lot about everything else Oklahoma's done. Yeah. That's very, very impressive that football is sixth based on the way they panned out the last year or two. Yeah, obviously, it's an indictment on Texas football and Nebraska football.
Yeah.
Oklahoma football's still really, really good, but it is interesting.
Yeah, there's no question who is number one on Oklahoma's campus.
As dominant as
that softball team's been the last 2 years.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is kind of crazy when you start thinking about all those sports and how much success they are having in different sports. And then you kind of look at the other schools and ask, why are they not having the same kind of success? You know, like,
right.
Why can't football lead to success at other schools? But obviously, it's who you hire, it's who you recruit, and Oklahoma's clearly doing a good job of that in a lot of different sports.
KU had a run there for a short period of time where they had their volleyball team was making the tournament. Their women's basketball team made, I think, Sweet 16. The men, of course, made it to the Final Four, always, you know, ranked high. A football team won the Orange Bowl. I mean, there was a short period of time where Kansas had a lot of things going really well in every sport. K-State, I think, had a span, too, as well.
I had three trophies in 1 year in 2013, three Big 12 championships,
right.
You know, football, basketball, or 12-13 school year
right.
in baseball.
Yeah, well, so, volleyball's had a good run at times.
Yeah.
They've been up and down. So every university, for the most part, probably goes through some spells, and there's no doubt Oklahoma and Texas are going through that spell right now. So kind of interesting. The NBA draft is set to take place tonight at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn. Auburn forward Jabari Parker is considered to be the favorite, to be the number one pick by the Magic. Paolo Banchero of Duke and Gonzaga's Chet Holmgren are expected to round out the top three picks. The Thunder have the second pick, followed by the Rockets at number three. The Kings and Pistons are out to top five. KU guard Ochai Agbaji, I looked at the mock drafts. Some have him as high as 8-1, and some have him as low as 20, and not a lottery pick. Christian Brown, I saw one have him as high as 23 to the Sixers. Another had him 25 to the Spurs, which would really, really be tough for Dusty to deal with. You're in on a Jayhawk on the Spurs.
I've done it before. I can do it again if it happens.
Who was it that you did before?
Well, actually, he never played with the Spurs.
I was going to say, I don't.
He was supposed to get. It was supposed to be Marcus Morris, but he backed out and went. And
I was
going to
say,
2-year deal somewhere else.
I don't know the Spurs roster. I don't remember a Jayhawk being really good.
I can't say I was actually a Spurs fan when Jacques Vaughn played for him. So I can't say that I did that before.
So this would be an adjustment for you.
Yeah, Frank Mason played on their summer team, but I can't think of any actual KU guys to do it. Well, Drew Gooden, I think, actually did at one point.
Did he play in the Spurs?
I don't know if he did or not.
He played for almost everybody.
I don't think he did.
I don't think he did.
I think they were trying to get him 1 year and he never went.
Okay, so Dustin will have to adjust.
I don't think I'm going to have to worry about it, though.
Would you be okay? Would you be cool with Christian Brown being the first round pick of the Spurs at 25?
Yeah, they have two more before that. Mm-hmm. So I'd be okay with that. I don't think Christian Brown's game is going to translate to the NBA as well as maybe his projections are getting better at.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. For some reason, I just don't know. It's not about him being a KU guy or anything like that. I don't know how well his game's going to translate to the league.
It's
and
interesting.
So that's why I'm a little bit more leery on that, or maybe don't want that to happen.
This is me, but I think Christian Brown's a better player than Landry Shamet.
Oh, yeah, I would agree with that, yeah.
And Landry Shamet's still in the league and making good money and has been carried by a few teams, traded a few times, and still is one of the top players coming off the bench for the Suns right now. I'm pretty sure he's with the Suns right now. And there was many questions about him leaving.
Now, Shamet's thought he was crazy.
We all thought it was crazy. Shamet is a better perimeter shooter than Brown, more consistent. But Brown, to me, is more athletic, without doubt.
For sure, yeah.
So that'll be interesting. I think Brown could, if he gets in the right situation, I think Brown could have a long NBA career, but it's going to be a role player. Obagi, you know, my oldest said last night, he said, yeah, I think he's going to the Knicks. I said, Knicks would be an interesting fit with their roster. I really hope they both do well, but Ochai, I really hope, is in the right spot, too, because he's improved and worked so hard on his game over the years, and seeing that development from a guy that wasn't even basically recruited would be pretty special. So Brown is 23, 25, and some mock drafts. Some have him in the second round, so who knows? So we're talking about a 15-pick difference, basically, for both of these guys. So that's why it's a crapshoot. And then these so-called pundits and experts rank the athletes and the prospects and then sit here and tell you who's going to be a number one pick, and they don't know. Nobody truly knows right now. The two teams have forfeited second-round picks. That will be the Bucks and the Heat. So there's two Jayhawks to be drafted. And the draft starts at 7 o'clock tonight on ESPN. The Blazers already have traded for Jeremy Grant from the Pistons, gave up a 2025 protected first-round pick. Apparently, the Blazers are interested in trading their 7th pick for a player, so there's movement already. There is a consensus. There's the top three picks are going to be Chet Holmgren of Gonzaga and Paolo Banchero of Duke and Jabari Smith of Auburn. Those are the three best players. The consensus is that that's going to be the 1-2-3 order, but it could be different order. It could be Holmgren at 3, it could be at 2, it could be at 1. Chet Holmgren is 7'1", 195 pounds, soaking wet. So yeah. I'm going to ask you, if you had to rank the three players, okay, as to, you're the Orlando Magic, you have the first pick in the NBA draft. Which one of those three are you taking? I'm taking probably Jabari Smith myself, or Parker, excuse me. I'm taking Jabari Parker myself.
Yeah, Holmgren is third on my list. I'll say
I think he's third on all of us. That's my point.
I like what I see from Banchero.
I do too.
I think I might take him first.
I'm hoping he's at 2 to the Thunder, because I think he's going to be a solid player. I think he's a safer pick than Jabari Parker. I think Parker has more upside. And we see this a lot in the draft. The guys upside sometimes end up being awesome. I mean, better than you think. Jason Tatum, remember the Celtics traded down, drafted him, and that was the best pick in that round. Here's the reason why I have no knock on Chet Holmgren. He's 7'1", he can block shots, good defensive player. And yes, he's going to have to put on weight, he's going to have to put on muscle to compete in the NBA, I think. But I don't understand. The NBA isn't about big men. It's not like you need offense. I mean, the game is more open. It's up and down, and I know Holmgren can get up and down the floor, but 7'1", 195, and how physical the game is, I think it's a bad pick. To me, Chet Holmgren shouldn't even be in the top three discussion. But people get enamored with size, and then people have said something like they've thrown out comparisons like I've heard them say Giannis Durant. I'm like, what? This guy's nowhere anywhere near that. I mean, I don't see it at all. Maybe he can turn into that. And then other people have talked about, and I'll tell you the one that pops in my head comparison, is Greg Oden of Ohio State. Remember? It was him or Durant. Mm-hmm. And it was Oden. Oh, he's Oden's so big, and he's a shot blocker. But he wasn't a great offensive player. You got to get the big guy. Well, you know, Portland went with Sam Bowie back in the day instead of Michael Jordan. How'd that turn out? Another big guy over a 6'6", 6'7", type of guy. And the NBA now, more than ever, is about up and down. I mean, the team that just won the NBA championship, Kevon Looney was their center. Now, he was a defensive-minded player, doesn't score very much, and Holmgren could certainly be that. But Kevon Looney wasn't drafted in the top three of the NBA draft. And Robert Williams wasn't the top three pick in the NBA draft. And he's a very good defensive player, but he's not 7'1". He's 6'10", I think. I think the way the game is now, in a certain year back in the day, yes, it would make sense to go with Holmgren in the top three. I think it's going to be a major bust, is what I think, whoever takes Holmgren. And I'm just crossing my fingers the Thunder don't take him.
Yeah, I like Holmgren. I think I like him a little bit better than a lot of people. But I don't... I'm kind of like you, like, it shouldn't be a top three pick, you know. But, you know, to be fair to Holmgren, it's not his fault.
No.
Nobody else has, you know, taken that mantle. So he's going to be picked where he's picked, and that's just the way it is.
Kevon Looney was the 30th pick in the first round in 2015. And just to give you, I'm just going with the two teams that were just in the finals.
Right.
I mean, we're talking about recency. Robert Williams III was the 27th pick. See, to me, Chet Holmgren is a mid to late first round pick. He's not a top five pick, let alone top three. And some people think he might go one or two tonight.
Yeah. See, I don't see a bunch of all stars.
He played at Gonzaga.
I see a good career for him. I see a decent player for 8-10 years. Might take him a year or two to get there to bulk up because he's still really young.
Let me stop you. You don't think he'll be a star?
I don't think he'll be a star.
So if you're drafting at 1, 2, or 3, you got to draft a star.
Yeah. Right, right.
And then you evaluate what's underneath him. Do you think those guys are stars?
Yeah. So I think Ventura and Parker definitely would be.
These are two guys that we're talking about.
I'll tell you another
three,
one. Jaden Ivey from Purdue.
Yeah.
I would take him above Chet Holmgren.
Yeah.
I like Keegan Murray, too.
Yeah, he's good.
Yeah.
The Madison kid from Canada, from Arizona, I like him better, too.
Yeah, I think what NBA teams are thinking – and what the biggest difference is with Chet Holmgren compared to some of the guys you were talking about, like the Sam Bowies of the world and guys like that, and definitely Kevon Looney, is the guy can shoot the three ball.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're 7'1", 195, you're actually you bode better as that kind of 7'1". In today's NBA, we say, yeah, he needs to bulk up. There's no question about that. He needs to get bigger if he's going to play in the NBA. But he shot over 100 threes last year, shot 39%. That's at college. His three-pointer's going to be longer in the NBA. I get that.
And he didn't play in a major conference.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that's the difference is what I'm trying to say with how you project where Chet Holmgren can fit in the NBA compared to where Kevon Looney fits in the NBA, right? Like, he can do more for you offensively than Kevon Looney would ever dream of doing
for you. Well, he better if you're a top three pick.
Yeah, and I think that's why he's getting that kind of credit in pub and why he's in the discussion is because he can step out, shoot the three. He's not going to be an overly physical guy in the NBA, I don't think, unless he does, again, put on some of the bulk. But then if you put on that bulk, then you change kind of the body type of who he is. And it might take away a little bit of the reason people think highly of him right now, which is the fact, again, I feel like that he can hit the three ball. And if he trains on that and gets better on that, you're 7'1" and can shoot from the outside.
Right.
It changes a lot of how you defend a player like that, too. And if he can kind of master some of that and evolve and advance and grow with those skill sets that he already has, that's where it is. It's always
potential,
and it's always about what maybe can happen. But I really feel like that's the major difference with a guy like Chet Holmgren compared to Sam Bowie.
I'll just use an example. Banchero can shoot the three.
Absolutely.
Banchero, I don't think he shot 39%, but he definitely could get better. So could Holmgren. Banchero is more physical, wider body. Now, granted, Holmgren can put that on. I get it. He can put on more weight. I do get that. Banchero is 6'10", 250. So if Banchero is posting up Chet Holmgren, and he gets his body in the Holmgren, Holmgren ain't going to block that shot.
No.
And he's going to power him and muscle him, and it's physical in the NBA. So Banchero has a back to – he has post moves, and he has a back-to-the-basket game. He can hit the 15-footer. He can run the floor. He's a very good defender. Of course, Holmgren is too. My point being is that you're talking about potential, and both of them have great potential, and so does Jabari Parker. But Holmgren, there is a major question, and that is, can he deal with physicality? I know Banchero can, and he played in ACC bang against Baycott, of all people.
Yeah.
And we know he's got stamina. He's already got an NBA body at 6'10", 250. So, to me, if I'm the Thunder at two, I'm taking Banchero instead of Holmgren, but that's just me.
Well, I told you, if I'm the Magic at one, I'm taking Banchero. So, it's like, I like what he – the reason – Chet Holmgren's number three is because of everything you're saying about Banchero and, and Parker, whoever you're talking about here. It's the fact that they're better, I feel like. But some other people think that Holmgren should be in the top three. For me, Banchero is a guy that can do all those things, and he's going to be able to create his own shot, right? Like, if something's going wrong at the end of a set, end of a shot clock, I'm going to trust Paolo Banchero before I am Chet Holmgren of creating something for my team and actually going out there and doing something. He has a lot of the tools, and I think he has all the tools that you need to be an NBA player and be a successful NBA player.
I think
player.
Banchero's another Jason Tatum, really. I mean, in that level.
Well, if it is, you better take him number one.
Yep.
Jabari Smith, by the way, is a full year younger than Holmgren. So, and he's 6'10", 220. So we're talking Holmgren is a couple inches taller, but weighs 30 pounds less than Smith and 55 pounds less than Banchero. It's not like Banchero and Jabari Smith are 6'3". They're 6'10".
Yeah.
And they both can shoot it. I mean, Jabari Smith is 42% from three, better than Holmgren, and against the SEC competition. Now, I don't want to knock Holmgren because Gonzaga played some good non-con, but as Jason said earlier in regards to why you get knocked seeding-wise if you're ranked high at Gonzaga is, well, the WCC, it's a good conference, but you know, Holmgren isn't banging against the big bodies of the Big Ten and the Big 12 and the SEC all the time. So to me, the safer picks, honestly, and I think have as much potential, is Smith and Banchero. And yes, some of the pronostications have Holmgren going at three. I'd have to see if I want to go with Ivy or Manichin or whoever else is that's maybe 6'5", 6'6", 6'4", instead of Chet Holmgren. But there are people that have Holmgren going number one tonight. There are people that have Holmgren going two to the Thunder. And I think that's a mistake. I think he's at best the third best guy in this draft. And I think whoever takes him one or two, if Holmgren goes two to the Thunder or the Magic at one, I think it's a mistake. But we shall see.
Yeah, I like Banchero and Smith a lot better than I like Holmgren. I don't.
They
like,
got NBA
like
made
Holmgren.
Bodies already.
Yeah, yeah. And I think I'm higher on Holmgren. Obviously, I'm higher on Holmgren than I think anybody here. But I think three is about right for Holmgren. But Jaden Ivey, I think you can get another guy like Ivey somewhere else. But Keegan Murray, I think is. To me, I think Keegan Murray, the world needs, you know, Cam Johnson's and Trevor Ariza's and those guys. Just, you know, I think he's the safest thing to be a 10-year, six-man type level player. Now, you know, that's the top five pick. Yeah, you want a little bit more out of that. But I think Keegan Murray has the ability to score, second to just Banchero in this draft, so I think Keegan Murray's got maybe the lowest floor of all these guys. I don't know if that makes sense, or the highest floor is what I'm trying to say. Is I think Keegan Murray will always have a role in the NBA for 8-10 years. If at worst he's a six man that just comes in and scores.
I think the biggest point I want to make is when you're picking one, two, or three, or even four or five, it ain't about getting a guy that's good for 8 years.
I don't want Trevor Ariza if I'm picking
want Kevon Looney or Robert Williams. Yeah. If I'm a late first round, I'm cool with getting guys like that. But when I'm picking one, two, or three, I better get a guy
like Jason Tatum. Yeah. I need to get a guy instead of Sam Bowie. I got to get a Michael Jordan. I got to get a LeBron James, which was a no-brainer and an easy one to figure out that was an automatic, you know? But I've got to get one of the best players. I got to hit on this. If I miss, and the guy's a complete bust like Greg Oden, who had all kinds of injuries, Ohio State, and guess who? Durant was the better pick, and that was the argument. Which way you go? And obviously, I thought at the time it was Durant, but obviously now it's clear. You miss on these, it sets your franchise back so, so far.
I got it. When I'm in the middle of a you brought up LeBron James, right? So it makes me think of that draft. Like, the Pistons were really, really good right there.
Oh, Darko
Milicic.
They
picked Darko Milicic instead of Carmelo.
Yes.
What happens if you take – listen, I know Carmelo didn't win titles, right?
No.
But Carmelo was an elite NBA player,
right,
and one of the
– just won a national championship.
At a time during his career, was the best scorer in the NBA.
Right.
Like, could get to the rack and could – he was a walking bucket.
Yes, sir.
His team never won a championship.
Mm-hmm.
But what did the Pistons do after that group left? Absolutely nothing.
Nothing. Well, just to back up your point, this is talking about how you mess up. Darko Milicic was the number two pick in 2003, as you said. Do you know what his career scoring average was in the NBA?
Probably like 2.5 points a game at best.
Well, you're not nice to the guy.
That's what it felt like.
He averaged 6 points a game. He did play in the league for 9 years. Of course, 7 foot, you're going to hang around a little longer than some
guys. Especially
in
the way the game was played then.
But he only played 3 seasons for the team that drafted him number two.
Yeah.
So here's what the Pistons – so forget that he averaged 6 points a game in his career. The Pistons took him in the second overall pick ahead of Carmelo Anthony. Here's what Darko Milicic did with the Pistons. 34 games, averaged 1.4 points his rookie year. Second year, played just 37 games, 1.8 points a game. His third year with the Pistons, he played just 25 games, averaged 1.5, and then was traded to the Magic.
So with the team he played with, he didn't even average what I said.
He didn't
said
even
he
average
averaged.
Two. With the,
yeah.
No, you're right. Yeah. His best
that
year,
he was drafted by.
His only one time in his career did he play 80 games. Only one time did he play more than 70. And it was in 2006, and he averaged 8 points and 5.5 rebounds. That was his best season. And in the Timberwolves, he was 8.3 and 5.5, but he only played 24 games that year. He was hurt a lot, and it was a complete bust. And guess what? The Pistons set him back for quite some time, didn't it?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's
you
like, you got to make it
out.
Like, you can sit here and say, like, this is the pick I want to make because my team's good right now.
Right.
But when you're drafting, you don't have to just think about right now. You can think about down the road. And,
absolutely.
And, you know, if you add Carmelo Anthony to that team, because, I mean, they were good. LeBron might not make the finals.
Might not.
In 2007.
Could be.
You know, you add him to that team that still has some of those guys in the
veterans.
Back end of
mm-hmm.
it with Ben Wallace and Chauncey Billups, Richard
right.
Hamilton, guys like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you can maybe ride that out a little bit
Carmelo
longer.
Learns
Let
from those
Carmelo
guys.
Can learn from those guys.
Yeah.
And he's on a team that's already established.
Yeah,
we're not probably, we might not be talking about Carmelo the same way we do, right?
But
he doesn't
might
have
right.
an NBA ring.
He might
maybe
have,
he
a ring
have
too.
One.
That's
and
right.
so you do. You still got to hit, and you still got to understand what you're getting. And you don't want to be that team that says, oh, I picked Darko Milicic number two.
Or Sam
Bargnani when he was picked by the Raptors.
Oh,
that thing didn't work out the way that anybody wanted it to. And I mean, there's a whole laundry list of it, but you got to hit when you're this high. And
you have to.
And if you don't, it can set you back a long, long way.
A long, long way. And some of these teams have tanked to get to these situations,
yeah.
even though there's still a ping pong ball thing, and you still strike out. So then all that work to tank blew up in your face.
Yeah.
I'll let you go get that report real quick. Kyrie Irving's future with the Nets is uncertain. There are teams that are starting to circle to try to get Kyrie Irving. I would stay away from him myself. But the Lakers are considered the most significant threat, which I don't know if I buy this. Kyrie Irving would have to give up $30 million to be traded from the Nets to the Lakers. He'd have to agree to take a $30 million pay cut. Now, Kyrie Irving's a different dude. He's got plenty of money. He could do that. But the most he could make with the Lakers is $6 million taxpayer exemption. So he has a player option for this upcoming year. It is all he gotta do is all he has to do. It's totally his decision. The Nets can't even stop him. All he's got to do is say, I'm in. $36 million. I want it. I got it. Or he could not, and then, you know, possibly, you know, go to the Lakers on the $6 million tax exemption. So, see, if he opts out, he's a free agent, from what I understand. So it wouldn't even be a trade. But the Nets would save a ton on their cap and everything else, give them flexibility, maybe to build something special around Durant because the Harden experiment didn't work and the Irving experiment hasn't worked either. That would mean that LeBron and Kyrie are back together, and Kyrie left Cleveland because he didn't want to be little brother.
And that worked out great for Kyrie. Now, Kyrie has said, you know, in hindsight, I should have stayed with LeBron, and we had it good, and maybe they're thinking about reuniting. And my question is, where does Westbrook fall? Because he ain't going to be with the Lakers. Where are you going to – I mean, how are you going to do this? I mean, you get a $6 million exemption, you can take it on. You could still technically have Westbrook and Irving on your roster. I'm sure there's a way to do it. But you can't – for your sake of winning, have Westbrook. So who's going to take Westbrook, or do you cut it? Do you cut Westbrook and take a gigantic hit financially?
Yeah, I mean, you can't take that. Like, you can't take the hit. What you're going to try to
but
do
what are you
is
get
if
for
you
Westbrook?
Want Kyrie Irving, what you're going to try to do – is trade Westbrook for Irving. You're going to try to
Kyrie
opt into this.
Agree to make a trade before you opt in.
There's going to be a swap here.
Right.
But then you're like, does KD want to play with Westbrook again?
Right.
And I don't think he does.
I don't either.
But I think if that would happen, then KD would be your next guy saying, I want out of Brooklyn.
Yes.
And I don't think you're that far away right now from KD saying, I want out of Brooklyn anyway. And remember when everybody just handed the Nets the championship?
I remember we weren't.
When Irving and Harden and we're going to join KD, and it's like,
we kept telling people,
no.
You're not coming
and
up
so
around.
Now that thing, the Nets have tried this a couple different times, and it's just blown up in their face every time they try to build something that they think is going to be a winner, and it doesn't work out. You know, when they made the trades for Paul Pierce and Kevin Garnett at the end of their career, got Joe Johnson, right? And everybody's like, well, this is... No, it didn't work out then, didn't work out now.
No.
And it's just I don't know how much I buy the Kyrie to the Lakers thing either, though. So
yeah, I don't really buy it. But we shall see. I mean, if the Nets are...
I don't buy the $6 million
exemption
thing
I agree
at all.
With you. The Nets would do something.
It'll be a sign and trade.
I do buy the Nets would be willing to ship him off.
Oh, for sure. For sure. So definitely.
But you need to find a willing partner.
But yeah, again, the money he's going to make, he's not going to opt out and go somewhere if he can make the 36 and the Nets are going to trade him, right?
Mm-hmm.
He can still get all that money and get traded. You're not going to take an exception.
I would say it's possible. Whatever. I mean, it's possible.
The trade, I think, is possible.
Yeah, I think it's possible. Irving is a Laker. Still don't think it's going to work, but hey, whatever. Current and former NFL players passed away from the same organization. This is crazy. Late Tuesday night, linebacker Jalen Ferguson passed away at his Baltimore home. Baltimore police said no signs of trauma or foul play were suspected. Ferguson played in 38 games over the last three seasons with the Ravens. He was just 26. And his teammates say he was in the best shape of his life and was really wanting a starting position. Former Raven Tony Siragusa, the Goose, he died yesterday. He was a member of the Ravens, one of the best defenses in NFL history, as he was a defensive tackle for the Ravens in 2000 when they won Super Bowl 35 over the Giants. Siragusa played 12 seasons in NFL, 7 with the Colts, 5 with the Ravens. Retired in 2001 and was a sideline analyst on Fox football games on NFL from 03 to 15. He died yesterday at the age of 55. So a really rough day for the Baltimore Ravens organization.
Yeah.
Man, our last couple days. While addressing the media Wednesday for the first time since March, PGA Tour Commissioner Jay Monahan formally announced three new events, as well as a massive increase in purse size to eight other tournaments. He also discussed LIV Golf and fielded questions about the future of a PGA Tour that has never seemed more tenuous than it does in this moment. This is here's a soundbite from Monahan's press conference yesterday. This is the PGA Tour Commissioner as they're dealing with golfers defecting to play in the LIV Golf event in Saudi Arabia, or the Saudi Arabian back LIV Golf.
Let me be clear. I am not naive. If this is an arms race, and if the only weapons here are dollar bills, the PGA Tour can't compete. The PGA Tour, an American institution, can't compete with a foreign monarchy that is spending billions of dollars in an attempt to buy the game of golf. We welcome good, healthy competition. The LIV Saudi Golf League is not that. It's an irrational threat, one not concerned with the return on investment or true growth of the game.
Irrational threat. Irrational threat. Would you agree with that?
I don't agree with that.
Okay, why not?
Well, I don't think it's irrational because it seems rational to the actual people that are on your tour.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're making comments that are pretty serious about your tour's not what I want to be part of. I don't think it's irrational from that aspect. These guys actually want to do this and be a part of it. I don't know how you can call it irrational. I know the money is part of it, right? Like the money might be irrational, but
yeah, it might be a difference in word interpretation, perhaps. I guess irrational. I would agree with the way you looked at it. I didn't look at it the way you were. That makes some sense. But I think what he's trying to say, at least this is how I took it. It's irrational from the standpoint to think the LIV Golf's going to last for 5-10 years. It's not. This is a flash in the pan LIV Golf thing. Because unless the Saudis are just going to bankroll this thing for 50 years, there is no TV partner. I mean, yeah. there's not enough. You cannot make enough money to cover what they're paying these golfers. I mean, they're paying them $125 million, Dustin Johnson, according to one report, over $100 million just to be on it, let alone what he makes and he wins. Well, that's not sustainable. That is not sustainable unless, of course, you got billions of dollars. And like somebody said, they're just buying golf. Saudis are trying to buy golf to cover up, obviously, various things that have happened with their regime. And we're going to read a statement from 9/11 group that was released yesterday. It's very interesting. So I think what Jay Monahan is trying to say is, listen, is this a threat to us now? Yeah. But we're the better organization. We've been around for a very long time. It's the old adage, first one in wins. LIV Golf's going to be, this is great. These guys want to go make some money real fast next year or two? Yes. But do we really truly believe, do you guys believe LIV Golf is going to be a prominent part of golf 5 years from now? I don't think it's going to exist.
I don't. Probably
Who's going to keep funding probably this over and, no. over and no. over and over and over and over and over? And then you got bigger, longer travels, which I know they're paid. These guys are paid. I think some of these golfers are going to find out, wow, I don't want to be traveling all over the world. It's going to get a little old. Now, I love the money, but am I happy? Like Justin Thomas said recently.
There's a story that says LIV, and I got texted this. I want to make sure that this was legit. But it says they have $600 billion. In their fund right now,
right,
and so that so they're not expect they don't need to make money for 10 years,
but what's the advantage for doing this for 10 years? Like I understand the advantage. I'm not caring. They don't care about golf. The Saudis don't care about golf.
Yeah,
they don't care about the quality of golf. What they're caring about is this is a way. A 9/11 group says this as well. This is a way, and other countries have done this in the past, where it is a kind of a wipe the slate clean, try to make it look better with there's some issues politically within our country and all kinds of accusations and allegations, and that we're going to go ahead and brush it over with. Everybody's going to talk about, when they think of Saudi Arabia, instead of thinking about, you know, we took out a journalist, they're going to think LIV Golf. That's what they're hoping. This is all a misdirect. And the reason it can be a misdirect is because they have $600 billion. But my thing is, after it accomplishes what they want to accomplish, or if it's not accomplishing what they thought it was going to accomplish, they're not stupid. If it's $600 billion, they're probably not stupid. They're probably going to reinvest that somewhere else, right? Put it into something else. Maybe try to buy another sport. I don't know. That's why I don't think this is something that's long-lasting. Because, yes, if you have $600 billion, I guess you can just blow whatever you want to blow. But let me tell you something. I think there's better places to put their money than that long term. And I don't think the goal of the Saudis in an investment fund is to rule the world of golf for the rest of eternity. Do you?
No.
Don't you think this is a short term plan? Or do you think this is a long term plan that they're going to convince every American golfer and every golfer in the world to play on their tour, and then America won't have a PGA Tour at all? Do we really think that's going to happen?
See, I don't know if they really care if America has a tour.
I don't think they do.
If it continues in America. I do think it is, on one hand, I do think it is a somewhat legit business venture. Now, they might, you know, like you said, they may very well be doing it because they get some added benefits to it to try to whitewash some things. If that's an added benefit, then I think, yeah, they're fine with that too. But I do think somebody's trying legitimately to make money or to make something out of this. I just don't know. You're right. I just don't know if it's going to last. If it's not really making money or making a big splash, say year 3 or 4, you're probably not going to see all that $600 billion. Like you said, they're probably not going to be as patient for 10 years and all $600 billion. That also sounds like somewhat of a bluff to the PGA Tour.
Right.
So they very may well have a lot of money and very may well be able to do this for a few years. But to say they don't need to make money for 10 years and they have $600 billion seems outlandish on both ends. And it seems like a little bit of a shot at the PGA Tour and a little bit of a call my bluff type moment, I think. I'm willing to believe they have money and they have a little bit of patience, but I'm not willing to believe 10 years and $600 billion.
Well, first of all, just because the fund has $600 billion doesn't mean that they're putting $600 billion right. in the LIV yeah. golf. So right. just because somebody says, well, they have $600 billion, they can do this forever. Yeah, do you really think they're going to just go ahead and roll no. it on the roulette wheel and go no. black or red or whatever no. and say, oh, hit me. I got a 20. I'm going to put $600 billion and I got an ace coming. No.
If this is a break-even venture at year three, then...
It's a drop in the bucket, by
right,
the way.
Right.
What the point of saying that there's $600 billion in this fund is to say it's a drop in the bucket what they're already spending to do what they're doing. I get that. But don't sit here and try to tell me that's a $600 billion fund for LIV Golf. No, it's not. It's an investment fund of $600 billion. You diversify. Yeah. There's probably a reason. Well, first of all, oil is a big reason why they have $600 billion in this fund, more than likely. Yesterday, an open letter was made public from 9/11 family members thanking PGA Tour players for not joining the LIV Golf Invitational Series that is bankrolled by the Public Investment Fund, which operates on behalf of Saudi Arabia. The letter says, and I quote, "Thank you for standing up for decency. Thank you for standing up for the 9/11 families. Thank you for resisting the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia's efforts to cleanse its reputation by buying off professional athletes. Some of your fellow PGA Tour members have traded their dreams of earned success for easy money. Indeed, blood money. Whether they need those funds or not. They include some of the richest in the field who justify their roles in Saudi Arabia's efforts to sportswash by simply and astoundingly looking the other way. They do so casually when asked the hard questions or are faced with the uncomfortable truth that they are helping one of the world's most, that they are helping one of the world's worst regimes paper over its crimes. To those of you who have chosen what is right over blood money from a corrupt, destructive sports entity and its Saudi backers, please continue to stand strong. You inspire hope and conviction that our long journey to accountability and justice is in reach. We deeply value your integrity and your willingness to stand up for principle." Now, that is a letter that is not holding back. That is a letter that flat out is saying exactly. Now, of course, you got to remember 9/11. And you wonder why the 9/11 group, if you don't know younger people out there, well, what do you mean? What do you mean 9/11 group? Well, if you don't know what happened on 9/11, you need to study. The worst terrorism act on our country's soil. Not even close. And so Osama bin Laden and 15 of the 19 hijackers on 9/11 were Saudis. So there's a lot of pain there, obviously. And to see Phil Mickelson even say bad things about the Saudis in a book excerpt that gets released, he knows what they're like. The bad thing for Phil is that he actually said it and knows it. And you would hope all these other golfers that are going there know it as well. But they're at least being smart enough to not say it out loud. But then they look like they don't care. Or they're doofuses that are just, oh, I just signed up for the money. I had no idea they were tied to 9/11, which you know they're liars. So they basically don't answer these questions because they're all in it for the money. And that's the sad part, is that there can be a investment fund through Saudi Arabian or backed by Saudi Arabians, whatever it may be, that you can just buy the best players in golf and bring them over and play on a tour.
Yeah.
That is disturbing. That is scary. And we talked about how money rules so many things in society. Let's be honest. Money rules what happens in D.C. Money decides whether or not we have bills reformed or changes in bills and laws. It is run by money, and in many cases, lobbyists have more power than politicians. And lobbyists are usually former politicians that got knocked out of office, okay? So money rules, in the case, many, many situations. The PGA Tour is having to make adjustments that they were planning on making, according to Monahan. But now he admits we had to accelerate this process. More tour events, more money, taking care of the bigger players, the better players more so. The problem is now you're hurting some of the players that are trying to get to that level. All right. They're going to reduce the fields in certain cases. And so what's disturbing is if you have $600 billion, guys, as the person told you this, $600 billion, why would they stop at golf?
Well, they're probably not going to stop.
Well, probably not. Right. So if this is successful, wouldn't it just strengthen the, you know what? Hey, we just bought off America's. We just took out. We knocked down. The PGA Tour has been around for forever. We just knocked out the number one source of golf in America. We just took them out. And we got like half of the great golfers already with us in year one. What about tennis? What about soccer? What about pro basketball? I mean, who knows where it goes? I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, who's to say you can't start your own professional basketball league? And if you can get LeBron James to come over, hello. I mean, think about it. If you just do the equivalent, golf, you don't think the Saudis can, with $600 billion, can build a state-of-the-art arena and just have tournament after tournament? And, I mean, come on. If you can do it for golf, you can do it for other sports. And that, to me, is the alarming thing. And that is the disturbing thing and the scary thing to me. I am hoping this is a short-term thing. I believe it will be. I think the whole idea behind it is to cover up and make people think of, well, you think of Saudi Arabia, you think of, well, oil is what I think of, but and money and the prince and all this other stuff. But other people may go, well, I thought of Saudi Arabia in a negative light, and now all of a sudden, oh, yeah, that's that LIV Golf. Well, guess what? You just went from putting them as a bad regime to now suddenly over time, LIV Golf. Mission accomplished. That's what they're saying, the 9/11 group. That's the goal, is to cover up and cleanse over everything else and get people to talk about golf and be, I call it a misdirect, you know, just like politicians when they don't answer your question and start talking about something else, like, whoa, that's not what I asked you. And they'll still misdirect over and over and over because they'll never answer the question. And I think that's exactly what this is. And I don't know how long it's going to last. But if it gets to a point where there's so much backlash to where some of these players say, you know what, this isn't right, I'm going to drop out of LIV Golf and come back. Or if a few go, okay, they raise the purses. So now if it was a money thing, yeah, we're not quite where LIV Golf is, but I'd rather be here than going to London and wherever, all the places I'm going to go. Money isn't everything. And that's what some of these players may find out. Because this is the first time these golfers had a chance to be really, in essence, free agents. Although technically they could have played on the Asian Tour and all these other places. So the allure of the money, going to a few new places to travel, probably is nice. My question is, Dustin Johnson, Brooks Koepka now, Bryson DeChambeau and others, Mickelson's, you know, the back end of his career. But those guys, are they going to say, okay, that was interesting and different, but it's not the same. I got to go to these tournaments all across the world. I got my bag. I got my $125 million to be on this tour, or $100 million or $75 million, plus my winnings. Okay, that's plenty to live off of. And I'm tired of traveling all over the place. And I come back to the PGA Tour, who will accept them with open arms, trust me, if they say, okay, I'm not going to do any of this anymore. Then this thing is dead. LIV Golf is dead after the honeymoon period wears off. And I don't think the plan for LIV Golf is to be a player for decades. I think the plan is to be a few years type of thing. Maybe it'll last longer than that. But the question is, will you have enough of the top players in the world play LIV Golf for an extended period of time? And I think I would lean towards no. I think there are going to be a few more players that certainly will try it out, like Brooks Koepka did. And you don't know what to believe with the players. They say one thing and say something else. I mean, if Roy McIlroy goes, boy, you talk about just take it all apart. But I don't think this is a long-term plan where this whole idea is we're going to take over golf for the rest of eternity. And I don't, because listen, if you lose the best American players, you have no interest from America. If Dustin Johnson ain't playing, Brooks Koepka, Bryson DeChambeau, if American players, except for some Joe Schmoes that you don't know much about, if the top players, and that's all key to LIV Golf. That's why they offer $125 million. Hey, come on over, DJ. Yeah, because you got $600 billion. $125 million is nothing to them. But I think it's a short-term thing, and I think the players will eventually say, okay, wins enough is enough. How much money can I possibly make? Am I happy doing what I'm doing? And if I get my bag, and I think that's why some of these players are doing it, I think there's starting to be a rush, a few of these players, because they know this ain't going to last forever. Let me go get it while I can get it, and then I can still play the majors, and I can come back, and I'll be back on the PGA Tour once this thing either dies off, or let's take advantage of their money, which some people say is blood money. I'll go ahead and take their blood money for a year or two, and then I'm back on the tour, and that'll kill LIV Golf. I just don't think LIV Golf is going to be a prominent piece of the golf landscape, I'm going to say, 5 years from now.
I'll say they'll still be here 5 years from now, just to be different. One of the big things I think that people
don't you think
might,
the novelty will wear off?
It might, but if what you say that they're trying to do it and get their bag now because they think it's going to be gone in the future, then maybe so. But right now, 20% of the top 50 golfers are in LIV. And it's not that I don't know if that's going to slow down or if it's going to keep going. We don't know.
There's also been only one tournament they've had.
Yeah, but one of the biggest focuses, I think, that people don't realize, 5 of these 8 events are going to be in the U.S. They're not traveling like you think they're traveling.
Well,
like
they're
like
going
some
to.
People
that's
think
what,
they're
that's
traveling.
That's going
to
be the plan. They're
well, yeah,
expand,
eventually
they're
they'll expand to different places in the world. But right now, the travel is not any different than a PGA tour, really. I mean,
the PGA doesn't go to London.
Well, I mean, they go for the British Open, once again.
I
mean,
that's
the European
that's a
tour.
Major.
Some of these guys are going to be European guys that are in LIV too, and they're going to be traveling around Europe. So it's.
But you're also
not
being seen. You have no TV. Broadcasting, no partnership whatsoever. So you're going to get the money. You're not even seen.
Yeah,
so
I'm just pointing that part of it out because I think people think it's a Saudi-backed league. They must be traveling all over the entire world. There's one tournament in Saudi Arabia. There's one in Thailand. And then there's the one in England. The rest of them are in the U.S. The Portland one is coming up. And then they have one in New Jersey, Massachusetts, Chicago, and Miami. So that's where they're going this year, right? I wanted to put that out there because I think people might think, oh, they're traveling all over the place to play golf and make money. Really, they're not. They're going to Thailand and England and one tournament in Saudi Arabia. And so
they're going to England, Portland, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Chicago, Thailand, which is out there, Saudi Arabia, and Miami, Florida. Those are the 8 tournaments as of now. I think they would grow it if they want to grow it, which I don't know. Maybe they'll stick with the 8. And you would think they'd want to spread their wings
places.
And go elsewhere. Now, let me ask you a question, though. So if you're talking about the players, the 9/11 group talks about blood money, and they're focusing on the players. What about Pumpkin Ridge Golf Course in Portland, Oregon? What about Trump National Golf Club in Bedminster, New Jersey? What about Rich Harvest Farms in Chicago, Illinois? What about the International Course in Boston, Massachusetts? What about Trump National Golf Club Doral? Notice there's 2 Trumps in here. Miami, Florida. Shouldn't they catch a lot of backlash and heat?
Well, I mean,
should catch major heat. If the players are going to catch a whole bunch of heat, and granted, without the players, you don't have this LIV Golf. But at the same time, if you don't have a place to play that hosts and has sponsorship, the players got nowhere to play either. It works both ways. So I want to hear the 9/11 group put a ton of pressure on these country clubs and golf courses in America that are hosting these things that are allowing LIV Golf to thrive. They should.
Well, yeah, see where a couple aren't going to
There should
care.
Be all kinds of protests at these events, that's the next thing. When the golfers, American golfers in particular, which let's be honest, some of the best ones in the world is what they were targeting, obviously. Koepka, DeChambeau, DJ, of course. If there's enough backlash, I think these American golfers are going to be like, you know what, dude, I got to stop this. Now, the question is, will the backlash be consistent enough to keep going or will it just die off? I don't know. But it is a bad look for these golfers based on the history of Saudi Arabia. And one of them admits about it.
And the worst part about that is, like, Phil Mickelson was the last person that needed to do this.
That's the – yeah.
Yeah, you know, he was the
This is like a shot at the PGA Tour. He's had his problems with PGA Tour.
Yeah.
I think it's spiteful. That's probably what it was.
Well, that's why Sergio's in it. There's no doubt about
Sergio,
that.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people don't like Sergio, but that's a story for another day.
Well, yeah. But.
You know, you're right. These courses or hosts or people that sponsor these things should receive some of the backlash as well. But I can, you know, if this LIV Golf says, hey, look, we'll pay you this much money, and that could probably fund these courses for a year. There's probably money that they don't see from the it's just like the golfers are getting paid over. I'm sure to rent the course or it's an extraordinary amount to make them look the other way from this backlash and lack of and maybe a sponsor or two dropping out. You know,
this is the alarming thing to it though. To go one step further to finish the show here, this is the alarming part, and it already happens, I know, in some capacity, but. If you can buy off golf courses and country clubs, we know government officials have been bought off before, state officials have been bought off before, and maybe this has already happened in our time and we don't even know it, or some people even allege it has happened. If you can have that much influence, $600 billion or whatever in this fund, there's probably other funds for all I know, $600 billion fund.
This is just the public fund.
Right, public fund, right. There's more money.
That's what's crazy
about
it.
That ain't all they got. But the point I'm trying to make is if you can just come in a short period of time and ravage the PGA Tour that's been in existence for forever, and you can take over golf, and let's say they are successful, and you can just buy whatever you need to buy. You can, Pumpkin Ridge is going to host it? Fine, we'll give $5 million to you, Bullitt Country Club.
Right.
Think about it. I mean, seriously, like, hey, Colbert Hills, they could target golf courses that they know financially are struggling to stay afloat. Hey, we will give you $5 million, $10, $20, $30, $40, $50 million to host this event. And the courses and the clubs are probably going to take the money. The point being is they don't even care who's buying it from. They just take the money and run. Why can't the same fund or funds, and like I said, could already be happening, simply say, here's $100 billion and we're going to take care of, we're going to be the person that's actually supporting the president of your country or your top leaders. And it may already be happening for all we know. But that's the scary part to me. If you can easily just come in with a fund like this and just wreak havoc on a war organization, imagine what other havoc you can wreak. And here's the thing. There doesn't seem to I could be dead wrong here, but it doesn't seem like a lot of people in our country are high on scruples. Like, I mean, we've talked about it before. If somebody walks up to you and says, you got to quit your job and you got to move to a certain place, but I'm going to give you $5 million to do it, most people are probably going to do it. You know, we talked about it. Players that leave early that don't want to play in a bowl game are going to protect themselves in football to get their bag. As Andrew Wiggins and Jordan Poole said, we're going to get a bag. Yes, you're going to get a bag of cash. So what it means is, and this is the bad message it sends, and this is what 9/11 Group is trying to say, is that these players are turning an eye. They know the history. Trust me, they do. They know, and they still don't care. Because they're putting their own selfish interest ahead of everything else. They're willing to deal with the backlash, apparently, and they want the money. Whether it's blood money or not, they're going to take the money. They're going to take the bag. So when they're trying to add a ninth event for LIV Golf, let's say, and they want to add a sixth event in America, whoever is the person that makes the call and says, hey, Oklahoma City, you got a nice golf course. We hear you've been struggling. We'll give you $25 million, and we're going to have this ninth event. Do you think they're going to say no?
No. Most places.
Most places are going to say yes, which means it don't care who you are. It don't matter if you're a horrible person. It don't matter if you're the worst person in the world or a criminal. I will take your money gladly, no matter what.
And
that's the message that many people are upset with these players doing LIV Golf. Some people say, hey, they have the right to do it. And they do. They have the right to do it. It's a free country. They do have the right to do it. I'm just providing both perspectives here. You can understand where the 9/11 Group is coming from. Like, at some point, don't you got to stand up for something?
I think what and kind of goes along with your fears also. We're only getting farther away from the event with the journalist.
Yes, and, exactly. That's the part of the goal.
Yeah, Phil Mickelson probably should know better. But, you know, that doesn't mean that this next generation of golfers who are younger and don't know all the, it's hard to believe that we're going to be able to see this, but, you know, it's hard to believe that, you know, some of these new golfers aren't going to be they're not going to remember.
That's right.
9/11.
That's going to be part of it, too.
Yeah. So we're getting farther and farther away from that. Mm-hmm. We're getting farther and farther away from the event with this journalist. We're getting farther and farther away from and we do this thing anyway right now where we're loud for 10 minutes and then it dies out. And we find something else that we're loud about for 10 minutes and then that dies out and then find something else that we're loud about for 10 minutes. So I'm sure Live Golf is just thinking, we just need to get through the first wave. And from there, in their mind anyway, it's going to be a little more clear sailing.
And to talk about the conversation, the things that we're loud about for 10 minutes, why are we loud about them?
Right.
For the same reason Saudi Arabia is starting a Live Golf League, to cover up other things that are not being talked about.
That's right.
Because we're loud about these things.
That's right.
Listen, I don't want to get into a government conspiracy conversation, but we get loud in America about a lot of things
that are small scale.
And that does not bother the people that have the power in America.
That's right.
Because they know, at least they're not talking about this, right?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And y'all watch House of Cards. If you've seen it, that's partially based on true things that are happening, right? And I don't know if everybody's seen House of Cards on Netflix. I would encourage you to watch it. Not all of that stuff is probably happening, but a majority of that stuff has probably happened, and that's probably where they get the ideas for it from the political landscape of it. I think the biggest thing for me is, like, we sit in this world where we want everybody to have a moral high ground.
Right.
And it's like, y'all have the money and power in Washington, and you're talking to me about having a moral high ground. Like, you're not doing anything. Some people feel like you're not doing anything there other than bickering back and forth.
Right.
And listen, I get it from the 9/11 group that's talking about this. I understand their angst, and I'm actually with them on it, right? Like, I understand 100% because I did. I didn't live through 9/11 like they lived through 9/11, but I was alive through 9/11, right? I know what it meant to the country and the impact that it has had on every generation that has swallowed that. But it's just like some of the people that are preaching moral high ground the most need to just kind of look in the mirror, right? Like, it's just like, I don't know.
Well, let me.
So that's the thing for me.
No, I hear you. I agree with you. And I'm glad you cleared that up in regards to the tour. I didn't realize there were that many in America. The 8 tournaments, I didn't know 5 were in America. But like I said, that adds another moving piece to me. A moving target is, you better be mad as hell about these places hosting in America.
Mad about these American golf courses hosting, if you're mad at the golfers that are doing it.
Right. But let me ask this question, and I'm going to leave this is the last question to everybody that's listening right now on the show. And you may be listening right now and going, yeah, that's wrong. What these players are doing, going over and taking that blood money or taking that money, it's wrong. Okay? And it's easy for us to sit here and not be offered this money and say it's wrong. It's easy for any of us to say that. More than 20 PGA Tour players, including former major champions Brooks Koepka, Phil Mickelson, Dustin Johnson, and Bryson DeChambeau, have signed with Live Golf. We know that. They also are receiving signing bonuses. So let me repeat, signing bonuses. Koepka hasn't even played a single stroke yet. Swung a club on either of these tournaments. There's only been one tournament that's been played. Those guys I just mentioned have received signing bonuses between as much as $100 million to $200 million, according to published reports. What you're doing is you have a fund that is $600 billion, as was stated earlier, and $100 million for $500 million divided by 5 guys means each of them gets $100 million. That's a drop in the bucket. That's like you and all of us finding a penny in the couch cushion. Like, we don't act like it's anything, do we? We find a $100 bill, we go, woohoo, $100 bill. We find a dollar bill, whatever. Well, this is their dollar bill. And so people go, well, that's so much money. Well, not $100 million's nothing compared to $600 billion. But here's the question that I want to leave with people. And I honestly can't tell you for sure how I would answer it because I've never been in this position. So maybe it's an unfair question to ask. But if somebody comes up to Dusty Dynas or to Jason Broadfoot or to Wade Gershner or to, you know, anybody out there listening right now, you can put your name in the blank. If anybody comes up to you and says, we want you to play on our new tour, it's called Live Golf, and you're a really good player, a really valued employee, or whatever you want to put in there, and we are going to, we want you so badly that we are willing to give you, in this case, let's just go the low number, $100 million. Man, I said the low number, $100 million to $200 million. So somebody comes up to you, you don't even know exactly what they're about, and they say, I will give you $100 million to leave your job and play on this tournament or come to be my work for me. What's your first reaction?
What do I sign?
For most people, I think so. And I also think the first reaction is, wow, your jaw drops, right? Because you're caught up in the money. Yeah. Your first thought is the money. Your first thought isn't, who would I be working for?
Exactly.
Your first thought immediately is, $100 million, what could I buy with that? I mean, I think that's the natural feeling.
And
you should be, if you're this great moral high ground person, right? You should be saying, what am I going to be doing for that $100 million? Where am I going to be working? Yeah. Where do I have to move? Now, those are all questions that come later. But I think you're exactly right, Dusty. I think many Americans would say, where do I sign? I don't even care if there's criminal activity tied to them years ago. If I know I'm going to be safe here, protected with $100 million, I'm okay with it. I'm going to catch some heat from people that don't even know me saying I shouldn't do it. You know, that's still $100 million in my back pocket. $100 million. I can help a lot of nonprofit organizations. I can donate. I can help in different ways with that $100 million. And that ain't counting anything else. You're telling me I can make more money if I perform well? I get $100 million just to compete? I get $100 million just to work? And if we hit our goals at the banking industry or wherever it might be, I get a bonus?
Right.
Are you serious?
Which is a bigger bonus than any other company can give you if you win.
Exactly. So how would people actually, if they were presented with this and say, I will give you a $100 million check right now. All you got to do is sign a dotted line and play on Live Golf, which I don't know if it's a one-year commitment, 2 years. I have no idea. Even if it's 1 year, duh. I mean, 1 year would be like, well, that's even better. I'm not locked down. Next year I can go back to wherever it is maybe or whatever, or I can retire. But come on, people. Let's think about it. You're going to stop, and first of all, you're going to be blown away by the number. Even if somebody comes up to you and says a million, that gets people's attention. $100 million is insane. And so I don't want to make excuses for these players that are choosing to go Live Golf. But they are human. And these other players at the PGA Tour are sitting here going, watching this closely, saying, could I be the next guy to get $100 million? Or if I play well enough here the next month or two, and I win a whole bunch of tournaments because some of the best players aren't playing, so I don't have to compete against them on the PGA Tour, so I have a better chance of winning some of these tournaments. Now, all of a sudden, I might be on Live Golf's radar, so now I'm going to cash that big check. And where does it end? It's fascinating to follow this whole thing, but if you, the people immediately tell you, well, there's a moral high ground, you're doing the right thing by not taking this money, and I agree, that's the right thing because You could argue the best players that are still in America are still making plenty of money to live. How much money is enough is what some people say. Well, but that could be the same thing if you're making $400,000, they offer you $2 million. Isn't $400,000 enough per year? Depends on how you live, I guess. Well, isn't $50 million a year enough for somebody? Yeah, I guess. I've never made $50. I don't know. Maybe it's not enough. I have no idea. But if somebody came up to anybody listening to this show or to any of us and said, I'm going to give you $100 million just to participate. I just want you to participate. Most of us would say, where do I sign?
Right.
So is it hypocritical for all of us or anybody to be all mad at those players for doing something that they legally can do? And they say, hey, I'm not met the people that hijacked anything. I'm not, the Saudis I've met are very nice. You know, I mean, you can play it off any which way you want. I guess that's the $64 million question.
Million.
Instead of 1,000. It is. It's going to be interesting to see how this plays because there's a lot of moving parts to it, and I just don't think it's something that's going to last long term. And maybe that's just me wishful thinking, hoping that it won't last long term. But if they're willing to keep pouring money into this, then yeah, I guess if they say we have a $600 billion golf fund is what they want to call it.
Right.
Well, then, yeah, then, yes, it will last 20 years or who knows how long. You could very well be right. It could end up being we got the top 24 players in the world. And that's all we want. That's all we want. It's an all-star tournament every week, although I think that'd get old, but whatever.
I will say they picked a smart target to start if you think it's a part of a bigger thing. Because golf is probably a little more accepting of some of these things, like the big money, there are a lot of people that feel golf is kind of an elitist,
yes,
rich sport.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It doesn't do society any good. It takes, yes, up land. It does this, that, and the other, water.
Private clubs. Segregated clubs,
yep,
for,
yep,
a long time.
You know, and we know the history on some of those.
Sure.
So there's, you know, they might have found a pretty good soft target to start.
That's a good point.
And maybe a little more accepting community to do this with. So, you know, it might be different with other things, but I don't know.
Maybe that was the thinking behind, mm-hmm, targeting golf all along.
Yep.
Maybe that you might be onto something there. Anyway, all I know is if somebody comes up to me a $100 million question, I have to tell you, I would be, first of all, I think I might die of a heart attack because I think that's what would probably actually happen to me. Before I could even say a word, I would stutter so much and just fall over in disbelief. But it's insane that there are people in this country, athletes, that are getting paid $100 to $200 million just to sign on and play on LIV Golf. And financially, how do you compete with that? Financially. Now, you can compete in other ways. But how do you, and as a result, they are upping the purses for these tournaments. But they still, as you just heard Jay Monahan say when I played the cut,
we can't.
It's an arms race. We can't compete.
State, regional, and national sports talk on your schedule. The Sports Ticket Podcast. Subscribe via Apple, Google, and TuneIn Podcasts or SunflowerStateRadio.com.